So how can we make this case? Well, one way we can do it is to point out to people that there's no essential difference between the embryos you once were and the adults you are today that would justify killing you at that earlier stage.
Arguments cannot be religious or non-religious. Arguments can either be valid or invalid, or sound or unsound.
The substance view is the idea that from when you come into existence at fertilization until you die naturally, you are the same individual at every point in your life. So if it is wrong to kill you now, it was wrong to kill you then.
Greetings and welcome to Pro-Life Thinking, a Life Training Institute podcast in which we will talk about the abortion issue and larger issues related to bioethics in a way that's winsome, reasonable, and persuasive. Joining me today is my regular co-host on our Sunday broadcast, Nathan. How are you doing over there, Nathan?
Pretty good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, your mic is probably a little bit loud. If you could maybe turn that down just a hair.
Yeah, or talk quieter.
Or talk quieter, either way, or you know, a little bit away from the mic should be good. Yeah, and today we have a special guest joining us, Christopher Kaiser, who we've brought on to talk about his book, The Ethics of Abortion. Chris, thank you for joining us on our for an interview today.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
I wasn't actually sent a bio, so if you wouldn't mind, maybe just take a couple minutes to introduce yourself a little bit for people who might not know you.
Sure. I was an undergraduate at Boston College and graduated from the honors program there. And then I went to the University of Notre Dame after that, earned a PhD there. After that, I was a Alexander von Humboldt Federal Chancellor Fellow at the University of Cologne and worked at Loyola New Orleans. Now I'm a professor at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles. But I have spent time also as James Madison Fellow at Princeton University, and I've written or edited 14 books.
Well, we've brought Chris on today to talk about his book, The Ethics of Abortion. He recently released a second edition of the book, and it's high on my list of books that every pro-life person ought to be reading. Don't just read it once. Probably, you know, read it every year. You know, memorize it, internalize it. Make sure you're studying the arguments, because this is just one of the best books you can find to defend the pro-life position. And it's even been defended or endorsed by abortion choice philosopher David Boonin. And so if it's endorsed by the other side, then you know that that is definitely something that's worth reading. Now, we're recording the show live. And so we've got Chris for about an hour or so. So we'll start it off here with a couple of questions, but we'll basically just open it up to callers whenever someone calls in and has a question for Chris. If there are no callers, you know, we have plenty of questions we can ask him ourselves. But if you have a burning question, something that you'd like to pick his brain on, you can call in at 646-668-8597. Once again, that number is 646-668-8597. Chris, I kind of like to start off every interview just with a kind of a get-to-know-you question a little bit. How did you become pro-life? Was it a series of events, or did you just kind of always be pro-life, or how did that come about?
I guess it was funny. The very first philosophical argument I ever had actually was about abortion. I was in fourth grade, and I was with my buddy, and you know, he came up with this example. I didn't know how it came up exactly, but we started talking about it, and he said, "Well, look, isn't it absurd to think that just a small speck, just a one-cell being, you know, has rights or has any dignity? That's purely absurd, right?" I thought, that's kind of crazy. And then, you know, so if the thing just has two or three cells, that's, you know, not really a significant difference, right? That's true. And so that was the first time I'd really thought about it seriously, and my friend, I thought, was making a lot of good points. So I guess I started thinking about it way back then. And then in college, though, is when I really started thinking about it more, because I had a roommate who was pro-choice, and so we debated about it a lot. You know, he was my roommate sophomore year and senior year and freshman year. He lived next door, so I just talked to him for hours and hours and hours about this. And I don't know, but then the more I talked to him about it, the more I came to see that the pro-life view is very well-grounded and very defensible. And so I guess in a way that was when I, you know, first really became pro-life.
Nathan basically set up the interview for today, so I'll go ahead and let him guide the rest of it, and I'll jump in if I have a question. So go ahead, Nathan.
Yeah, so the interview for today will just kind of follow the outline of the book, and then just kind of want to talk about the basis of the book, where the idea came from, and just kind of go from there.
Yeah, so I had been teaching the ethics of abortion in my classes, and looking at different articles, and there seemed to be some real classic articles on the topic. And I thought, well, it would be nice to have a book that kind of handles these classic positions. And so I kind of started basically from notes from class, working on a kind of project. And, you know, the more I worked on it, the more I thought, yeah, this could be a good little book. So I supplemented my work and, you know, didn't just go over a few articles, but I aimed to make it a very comprehensive work. In other words, what I wanted to do is try to find the most compelling and the most popular, in a scholarly sense, arguments in favor of abortion. And I thought, well, if I could really have a kind of handbook that would go through all the different views, it might be really helpful for people so they could have, you know, one book that would basically give a more or less, at least I aim to have it to be a comprehensive case that covers all the major positions that people put forward in defense of abortion.
It's definitely one of the, probably I think one of the top books that really lays out a lot of the scholarly, but also not, the lay level arguments too. In fact, just kind of going from there, one of the arguments that has come up this past week, especially on Twitter, it literally set Twitter on fire, if you get the pun. The burning research lab or the burning IVF lab kind of made a comeback this week. I believe it was a science fiction writer. His last name was Tomlinson. And he posted a series of tweets on the issue of given the whole burning research lab scenario. And it's kind of, it's not one of the best pro-choice arguments, but it's definitely one that has had a lot of people talking this week. So I do, sorry, Clinton, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, it's just, it's Patrick S. Tomlinson, a science fiction writer and comedian, brought this back up, and there have been a lot of pro-choice sites that have been just hailing this as if it's something new or as if it's something that Tomlinson has come up with. But pro-life thinkers have been addressing this thought experiment for quite some time now. And so even more amusingly, in his first tweet, he said that no pro-life person had ever answered his question honestly, and yet he's been blocking everybody who's been giving him answers to it. So that kind of, yeah, so that kind of puts a little bit of a damper on his credibility a bit.
Yeah, a mutual friend of mine and Clinton's, Elijah Thompson, who has a podcast called The Fetal Physician, he was one of the people that Tomlinson blocked on Twitter. Definitely a lot of pro-life authors. I know, Clinton, I think you published an article on it. Robert
yeah.
George and Christopher Tollison recently, they republished, I think, as an article, the section from their book, Embryo, talking about that.
They actually published an update to it because Tomlinson formulated it a little bit differently. They did address it in their book, Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, but they updated it a little bit just to address Tomlinson's formulation of it.
Right. Yeah, and I do talk about it in my book too, in chapter 7. So yeah, the idea that pro-life scholars, this is, you know, a big surprise to them and big news, is could only be made by somebody who was pretty much unfamiliar with any of the major people who criticize abortion.
Right. Yeah.
That actually describes a lot of people on Twitter.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, you know, it's for a listening audience, if they're not on Twitter or they haven't seen any of the comments or critiques of it going around, the scenario is basically you're in an in vitro fertilization lab, and in one corner is a five-year-old child, and the other corner is 10 embryos, 20 frozen embryos, and the lab is on fire, and so you have a chance to save either the five-year-old child or the 20 frozen embryos. Which one do you choose? And they will take people's indecision there and say, see, you don't even think the embryo is worth saving or protecting or is as valuable as the five-year-old child. And it's, like we said, it doesn't really reflect a lot of the arguments, both for and against the abortion position or even embryonic stem cell research, but it does have a lot of popular level support. Just kind of briefly, how would you respond to that one?
Yeah, what I would say is that there's a big difference between the question, who should you save, in a case where you can only save one or you have to not save people, on the one hand, versus the question, does this individual have a right to live? Or to put it differently, is it okay to intentionally kill this individual? So let me give a different case. You have the Prime Minister of England or the Pope or the President, and then you have 5 civilians or 10 civilians. Now, which do you save? Well, I would say that all the people in the room have a right to life, and so what that would mean is that it would be wrong to intentionally kill any of those people. But in terms of the question of who to save, I think it does make sense to save, for instance, a prime minister, a pope, a president, in part because if the president, for example, is murdered or dies, this can cause global ramifications. I mean, there have been world wars started over assassination of leaders. So the death of someone like that has such dire ramifications for all kinds of people that it is important to, it seems to me, save maybe one president, pope, prime minister, rather than 5 or 10 regular people. Another factor that seems to me is very relevant is in these triage situations is the likelihood of the people actually surviving. So let me give you a different case. You've got one perfectly healthy person, and then you've got 5 or 10 people that have stage 4 cancer that are about to die anyway. Well, it seems, or have a high likelihood of dying. It seems, again, it would make sense to save the one healthy person rather than to save the people, the 5, 10 people that have a very high likelihood of dying. And I think both of these factors are relevant for the embryo rescue case. The first factor is relevant in the sense that to save a 5-year-old child is going to have greater ramifications than to save embryos who are frozen who are already abandoned. In other words, if the 5-year-old child dies in the fire, the parents will be devastated. The brother and the sister will be devastated. Grandma and grandpa are going to cry. The people she goes to school with are going to cry. I mean, it's going to be a catastrophically devastating situation. By contrast, the embryos have been abandoned. There's no one who cares about them. There's no one presumably who would even know and care that they were not saved. So I think that's one factor that's relevant. The other factor that is relevant is that frozen embryos are already in a situation where it's pretty unlikely that they're going to survive. So what I mean is, in order for those embryos to survive, they have to be thawed successfully. Well, many times that doesn't happen at all. In other words, you thaw the embryo and it dies. It doesn't work. And then they have to be implanted in someone. Okay, so many times that doesn't happen. And then the implantation has to take and they have to grow. So in other words, the reality is that even if you tried your best to save the 5 embryos, in fact, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to save them at all. So in other words, in triage situations, it makes sense to focus on those people who really have a strong likelihood of surviving and getting through. And again, this has to take place in battle, right, where, you know, you might not try to, if you can only save a few, you would focus presumably on the people that had wounds that were not so life-threatening, more superficial wounds, because they look, I put the effort in and I can save the person who I can save. And you probably wouldn't in right. a triage situation try to save someone who is, you know, shot 10 times and, you know, very well may die anyway. In any case, the broader point is just to say that questions about who to rescue are not the same at all as questions about who it's okay to kill.
Right. So kind of moving on from there, the first chapter of your book, it really deals with the infanticide arguments, the arguments of Peter Singer, Michael Tooley, and then the more recent article, I believe it was called Why Should the Baby Live? And there was also the professor, I think it was the University of Chicago, Jerry Coyne, I think was his name. He had an argument. Clinton, I think you wrote a response to him arguing in favor of infanticide. So it's a very radical position, but it is starting to gain a lot of ground with some academics. So just kind of to talk about that real quick, probably because a lot of pro-lifers have never even heard these arguments before and wouldn't know how to answer them.
Yeah, so I think it is important actually to start with infanticide, because one way to think about the whole issue is something like this. Everybody agrees, or almost everybody agrees, that it would be wrong for someone to come in and kill you right now. Right? Someone just burst into your house or, you know, start strangling you right now, stab you to death. I think we'd all agree. Look, that's seriously wrong.
Right.
So you have a right to live right now. So the question is, well, when did you get this? And you know, clearly you had it yesterday, you had it a year ago, you had it probably 10 years ago. Some people would deny that you had it when you were a baby, right? That's the most radical pro-choice view, you might say. Yeah, you don't have a right to live until after you're born. And so Gio Bellini and Minerva, the ones who wrote the article, Why Should the Baby Live?, their view is that you gain the right to live at the point where you are aware that you exist and you value your own existence. And so in their article, they declined to state exactly when that takes place. They say it is after birth, but they don't say exactly when. But in my book, I actually did some research about when psychologists say that human beings gain self-awareness. And one of the tests for this is called the mirror test. It's basically where you make a mark on a child's forehead and have a mirror there. And if the child recognizes the mark, it says, you know, what, you know, kind of rubs their forehead, well, that indicates that they're self-aware. They can distinguish themselves, say, in a mirror from other children. Whereas people or individuals who aren't self-aware, like, you know, dogs sometimes, they see a dog in the mirror and they think it's another dog. And they go, you know, go fight, you know, start barking at the other dog. So for human beings, self-awareness begins to kick in basically around the age of two. Sometimes it could be a little earlier. Sometimes it could be a little later. So if there's a mentally handicapped human being, it might not kick in until 4, 5, 6 or whatever. But ballpark, if it's a normal, healthy human being, around the age of two. So if you put that psychological finding together with Gio Bellini and Minerva's ethical view, well, then you say that the right to live kicks in around 2 years of age. And I think that, yes, are there some people who endorse this view? There are. But I think that virtually everyone in our society, at least right now, would reject that view. I know in teaching this, I've taught that article and also an earlier version of a similar argument from a guy named Michael Tooley. I've been teaching that either one of those articles for almost 20 years now. And I've not had a single student who's ever said, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, infanticide up to, you know, 2 years of age, I sign on for that. People just are horrified by it. Now, they sometimes, so then the question is, well, what's wrong with this argument? And I think the argument goes wrong for a number of reasons. One of the main reasons I think it goes wrong is that it considers the right to live to be contingent on desiring your continued existence. And that seems to be quite mistaken. And I think, again, most people can see that there are all kinds of people around who don't have a desire to live that nevertheless, again, virtually everyone would recognize do have a right to live, right? In other words, it would be wrong to kill them. So I'm thinking, for instance, right, about people that are very depressed, right? There are many people that feel life, you know, sad and feel very depressed, but surely the answer is not, well, we should just kill them. They don't have a right to live either, and we just, you know, rather, what we would say is, no, they do have value, and if you're really depressed and you feel like you want to kill yourself, again, the answer is not to help you kill yourself, but the answer would be to, you know, get psychological counseling and whatever you need to get over your depression. So I think their view is rests on this kind of faulty premise that the desire to live is what grounds your right to live. Rather, I agree with the American founders who talked about inalienable rights. And the whole idea of an inalienable right is a right that you can't alienate, you can't give up. So my right to my watch is an alienable right. If I want to give my watch to Nathan, that's fine, I can do it. But my right to liberty is an example of an inalienable right. I am not at liberty to say, well, I'm just going to make myself a slave and you'll be the slave master. Well, no, I can't morally do that, and I believe our laws so states we can't legally do that. So that's an example of an inalienable right. In other words, it's a right that does not have a dependence on your desires. You may desire to become a slave. Well, no, you don't have a right to become a slave. And right. So if that's true, if there are inalienable rights, well, then to base our rights on our passing desires is a big mistake. There's a lot more to the infanticide question, but that's one way into the issue.
Yeah, you know, once, even as an adult, I almost failed the mirror test. I don't remember where I was, but I was coming out of a public restroom or something, and I saw someone approaching, and I tipped my hat to him, and it took me a few seconds to realize, oh, that's a mirror, and that's me I'm tipping my hat to. So I'm glad there are no moral philosophers around. I might have been in trouble.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm taking a psychology class right now for an elective, and we were actually talking about cognitive development and how it really things like moral agency and rational thinking don't really take place until, I believe it's age 7, younger children. They even lack the capacity to, I believe it's, think in terms of the abstract. They still have not developed to that capacity yet, but obviously nobody's going to say that they're less of a person because of it. So that kind of ties us into the next question that takes up the majority of the book is personhood. So you have a chapter talking about Marianne Warren's argument and her criteria for personhood, and then also some more of the gradualist views, and then the views very early on. So if you want to take those each one, take the late-term abortion and later-term pregnancy, is personhood there? Is it early on, or is it developed gradually?
Yeah, so if you think about the right to live, if you reject the view that it begins after birth, you know, two-year-olds have a right to live, one-year-olds have a right to live, newborns have a right to live. Okay, so then the question is, well, when does the right to live kick in? So the next possibility would be birth, right? Birth itself, that's the moment where the right to live kicks in. And in the new book I have coming out called the Abortion Rights For and Against, it's a book I co-authored with Kate Greasley, so I'm obviously having the pro-life side, she's the pro-choice side. Her view is that legally, at least, birth is the marker. So she thinks prior to birth, you know, abortion is should be permitted. After birth, no. I think this view really is untenable, and part of the problem with it is there's a consistency problem. So Jeff McMahon, who's a defender of abortion, points this out, that people who say, you know, pre-birth, late-term abortion is fine, but as Vanna said, is wrong, face a problem with consistency. And the problem goes something like this. Take a pregnancy 40 weeks, almost ready to deliver. Well, that prenatal human being is going to be much more developed than a prematurely delivered baby who's, say, delivered early at 25 weeks, right? So then you have this weird position where a prematurely delivered baby who's less developed physically, less developed psychologically, does have a right to live, whereas the full-term baby who's going to be born tomorrow and is more developed physically and more developed psychologically does not have a right to live. Well, it's hard to see why that should be the case. Now, you could say, well, it's because birth itself is so significant. Birth is what just transforms you from having no rights at all to having all the basic rights of any other human being. But then, of course, the question is, well, why? I mean, there's lots of other beings that are born, right? There's all kinds of mammals, right? Cows are born, dogs are born, kittens are born. But we don't say, oh, they're born, therefore they have basic rights. So birth just of itself seems completely irrelevant for having any rights, right? There's all kinds of creatures that are born that do not have basic rights. And we can at least imagine cases where human beings are never born. We say, what do you mean human beings are never born? That's crazy. Well, no, it's not crazy. There's such a thing as artificial wombs that are now in development. And if these scientists are successful, scientists at Tulane and also in Japan, if they're successful, they'll be able to put a human embryo in one of these artificial wombs, artificial uterus, a kind of prenatal unit, and develop the human being all the way through. So if that happens, these human beings would never be born of a woman. Mm-hmm. So what, they would never have rights? It doesn't matter if they're in 20 years old, they still don't have rights? I mean, that's a crazy view. That can't be right. So birth is irrelevant for your moral status. Your moral status doesn't depend on your location. Another way to think about it is the in fetal surgery, sometimes the child is taken outside the uterus, and then the surgery is done, and then the child's put back in the uterus. So if your location gives you your basic rights, you'd have to have the view that, well, prior to surgery, the human being in question has no rights and no value, doesn't count. And then during surgery, now all of a sudden, yes, this being has a right to live. This is a full person, just like you and me. And then the child's put back in the uterus, back to being worthless, doesn't just a bunch of cells, and then if there's another surgery later, back to being a person. That can't be right. That's just crazy. It can't be that our rights come and go back and forth depending on our location. So the bottom line is that birth just doesn't work at all as a way of differentiating those human beings that have basic rights from those human beings that don't have basic rights. Okay, so let's go a little bit earlier. Let's say, well, what about the moment of viability, right? Well, maybe that's when you have your basic rights kick in. I don't think that's going to work either. And part of the reason it's not going to work is for reasons I already mentioned, viability is something that varies based on technology. So 100 years ago, a child born at 25 weeks wasn't viable. Today, a child born at 25 weeks is viable because we have neonatal intensive care units that are much better than they were 100 years ago. If these artificial wombs are developed by the scientists who are working, well, viability will be pushed even earlier. And I don't believe that pro-choice people are all going to reverse their position if the New York Times tomorrow publishes a new story, you know, big breakthrough, artificial wombs now work from the very beginning. So I don't think anyone really holds that idea that viability is the key point. Peter Singer, another defender of abortion, points out that viability doesn't work in part because then you have this crazy view that if a woman is in Los Angeles near a hospital, she has the high-tech equipment available, okay, her baby's viable, so that baby has a right to live. She goes off camping in the wilderness far away from a hospital. Oh, now the child doesn't have a right to live anymore. She comes back. Child has a right to live again. Again, I call this in the book the episodic problem. It can't be the case that our basic rights, we gain them and lose them and gain them and lose them back and forth. That just doesn't make any sense at all. That can't be right.
Right.
So anyway, so I'm just talking about some of the points in pregnancy. Let me just mention one more. Some people would say, well, you gain the human being in utero gains the right to live with the development of a brain, right? Okay, the question is, why in the world should having a brain be relevant, right? There are lots of creatures that have brains. Worms have brains. Wasps have brains. Mice have brains. Rats have brains. They don't have a right to live. So clearly having a brain is not the key thing for having a right to live. So I basically think in the book I go over all the different markers. But the bottom line is that having carefully considered all the different options that have been put forward by defenders of abortion now for almost 50 years, I don't think any of them are defensible. And part of the reason I think that is that the pro-choice scholars themselves are quite apt at critiquing each other's views. In other words, in the book, what I often do is cite defenders of abortion to show why viability doesn't work, right? So Michael Tooley, he defends abortion and infanticide. He goes after the idea that viability is relevant in a very strong way. So, again, you know, right now in our conversation, we don't have time to go over every single one. But if you have a question about one or someone calls in with a question about one, I'd be happy to tackle it. But the bottom line is in my research about all the relevant positions, I haven't seen any plausible view about when the right to life begins during gestation.
If you are just tuning in late, you're listening to the Pro-Life Thinking Podcast. We're here with Christopher Kayser to talk about his book, The Ethics of Abortion. We're about halfway through our interview. And if you have a question for Chris, you can call in at 646-668-8597. Once again, that number is 646-668-8597.
Kind of caveating off of that, there was also the video that was going around a few weeks ago, the professor out at Princeton University, the video that James Franco did, the Philosophy Time. Do you remember the name of the professor, Quentin?
Elizabeth Harmon.
Yeah, Elizabeth Harmon, yeah.
A little bit of personal curiosity. What did you think of her argument? Do you think it works? Do you think it has some issues with it?
Yeah, I don't think it works. There's a great critique of it online at the Public Discourse by a great philosopher named Sharif Girgis.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he does a good job taking it down. The basic view is that if the woman is going to get an abortion, then the being in question doesn't have a future, and therefore it is not wrong to destroy the prenatal human being. If on the other hand, the human being in question does have a future, well, then all of a sudden it is wrong. Sharif talks about some of the problems with the view. One problem I have is, it seems to me it's clearly wrong, for instance, for someone else to kill a pregnant woman's baby. So this happens sometimes with boyfriends and terrible husbands where they will try to, make someone take you know, RU486 or try to get someone to get an abortion. So let's say someone does that. Let's say a guy tricks a woman into taking abortifacient pills, kills the baby. So on the view that abortion is only wrong if the human being in question has a future, well, then you say, well, what he did really wasn't wrong. And you might say, well, it interferes with a woman's autonomy or something. Well, okay, that's fine. But it seems to me that the action in itself is wrong, not simply because it interferes with someone's autonomy, but on account of what's being done. So it's an odd view to say that murder doesn't really count if the victim has a future.
Yeah, you know, when I was watching this video, and frankly, it was actually pretty great to have a big Hollywood star like James Franco with a video that actually had some substance to it. It seems like most videos by celebrities talking about abortion are really very bad. Bill Nye's video or some of the other ones. So I thought it was pretty great that a good and fairly strong pro-choice argument made it into the public square, and there has been a lot of good critiques of it. It seemed like a lot. She was kind of referring to Don Marquis's view, the future like ours argument. I know you talk about it in the book. I know you also have an article where you kind of expand on it and call it the flourishing like ours view.
That's right. Yeah. So Don Marquis's article on abortion is one of the classic views. And the argument goes like this, that it starts off with an intuition. Okay, why is it wrong to kill us? Why is it wrong to kill you? Why is it wrong to kill me? Well, it's wrong, he says, not because it takes away our past. In other words, if I get killed today, you know, it didn't take away yesterday or the day before. And he says, well, what's wrong with it is that it takes away your future. In other words, if you were to die today, what that means is tomorrow you couldn't enjoy friendships with people, you wouldn't be able to read interesting books, you wouldn't be able to go to movies. All the great things that would have happened to you tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day, are not going to happen anymore because you're not around. So what's wrong with murder, Marquis says, is it destroys, takes away a future like ours. That's what's wrong with it. It takes away our future. And the same reason applies not just to you and to me, but would also, for instance, apply to a newborn baby. In other words, if you kill a newborn baby, well, that baby is not going to grow up and is not going to have friends and is not going to go to movies and is not going to read books and is going to miss out on all the great things that make life so wonderful. But the very same thing is true not just of a newborn baby, but of a prenatal human being, right? A human being in utero. Well, they have a future like ours also. So the argument, I think, is pretty intuitively powerful. And in sharing with students, they seem to see the point of the article. Now, I have a similar argument, and it's based on flourishing like ours. And it's similar, very similar to Marcus's. In other words, why is it wrong to kill you? Well, it's wrong to kill you because it interferes with your flourishing, right? In other words, you're not able to flourish as a human being, obviously, if you're dead. And flourishing explains why it's wrong also to, for instance, maim you, to injure you seriously, you know, cut off your arm, cut off your leg. Well, all those things get in the way of your flourishing, right? If I cut off both your legs, you're not going to be able to go running, you're not going to be able to swim in the normal way. I mean, there's lots of great things that you are going to be prevented from doing. And killing you is, you might say, maximally interfering with your flourishing, right? You can't do anything,
right?
Not just physical things, but mental things. So if that's what's wrong with killing, it gets in the way of our flourishing. Well, again, the same thing is going to be true, not just for you and for me, but any being who has flourishing like ours. And that would include a newborn baby. That would include a prenatal human being. In other words, their flourishing is not substantially different from your flourishing or my flourishing, right? That is to say, what is a flourishing human life? Well, it's to grow and to mature and to be able to, hopefully, if you're healthy, to be able to do all these great things, like have friends, read things, go to the movies, et cetera, et cetera.
I know, Clinton, I think it came up during your debate, actually, this whole concept of flourishing when you debated Matt Dillahunty. I think this topic came up. Kind of moving on from there a little bit, a lot of people also think that the science is the issue. In fact, I was having a conversation the other day with a friend, and it's interesting to see where people go with the scientific arguments. It was really funny, actually. I was having a guy who was trolling my Instagram account, I had a pro-life meme or something posted on there, and a guy came on, and he posted all these academic links to academic articles. And so it was kind of funny watching people think they can make a scientific case for the pro-choice view, but not really being able to.
Yeah, I think there's an important point. In the Telegraph, there was recently a science article, and the title of it was something like, scientists enable human embryos to live longer than they ever have in vitro, right? So in other words, not in the womb, but in glass. And it was pretty interesting. This one article, in a way, is the heart of the pro-life view. In other words, human embryos, right? These are individual humans, and they're living, right? They say, well, oh, they're not living. When does life begin? Oh, we don't know. It's a big question. We debate about it. I don't think it really is a big question among people who are informed about contemporary embryology. I mean, here's one way to think about it. How do we differentiate living things from dead things? Well, it seems to me there's some activities that help us differentiate. So why would I say Nathan's alive, the chair is not alive? Well, for instance, Nathan grows, right? He has metabolic activity. And I'm talking not just growth in terms of height, because that obviously for humans at least stops at a certain point, but even people who are fully grown in terms of height do continue to grow and generate cells and replenish their body in certain ways. They assimilate nutrition, right? They respond to their environment. They have self-development, self-activation of various kinds. And this differentiates a living being from a being that is not living. So is the human embryo, is the human fetus a thing that grows, that has assimilation of nutrition, that responds to the environment? Yes, yes, and yes. And is the human embryo, the human fetus, a being that can die? Yes. No, only a being who's alive can die, right? A chair can be destroyed,
right,
dismantled, but a chair can't die. But I think people realize, yes, a human embryo can die, a human fetus can die, a human newborn can die. So it has to be a living thing. So
right,
this individual is alive. Second question, is this individual a human being? Well, this individual has human DNA, human blood, human tissue, a human mother, a human father. It has to be a human being, right? Any being that is result of procreation between a human father and human mother is going to be a human being. It can't be a chicken, a dog, a cat, a fish. It's impossible. So you have a living human being, and then you get to not a scientific question, but an ethical question.
Yeah.
And the question then is, do all human beings enjoy basic human rights? Or do only some human beings enjoy basic human rights? So everybody recognizes, or virtually everyone recognizes, that some human beings enjoy basic human rights, right? Those that are like us. The question is, do all human beings enjoy human rights? And so I think there are basically four good reasons for thinking that all human beings do enjoy basic human rights. And I'll be happy to tell you, too, when I answer that question.
we got time. We could go there.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually, if I could add something real quick, and yeah,
sure,
we'll get back to this here in just a moment. I've reviewed a book by an abortion choice physician named Willie Parker. He wrote a book called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And I've talked about how Parker doesn't support any of his claims when he talks about that life doesn't begin at fertilization. And someone had responded to my comment on Goodreads, which is a book website where you can do reviews and things like that. And he was trying to contest my point that life begins at fertilization. And he started quoting developmental biologists, not embryologists. So he wasn't quoting the actual experts on human embryos. But these developmental biologists were saying things like, life doesn't begin at fertilization. Life began tens of thousands of years ago, or hundreds of thousands, whatever the time frame is. And you have others who are saying, well, you know, I can't talk to an embryo. An embryo can't tell me whether or not it's alive. You know, it doesn't have cognitive faculties going on or anything like that. And so all of these claims are not scientific. They're actually philosophical claims, and they're being disguised as scientific claims. So one thing we do have to watch out for is when a scientist who's not an expert on embryos, but just a scientist in general, who says that there's no scientific consensus on when life begins, he's actually making a philosophical claim and disguising it as a scientific one. And so that's something we have to be on the lookout for also.
Mm-hmm. Just a caveat off of that, this is where a good usage of Greg Kochel's Colombo tactic would come in. When people say, well, nobody knows when life begins, it might be worth asking, well, what do you mean by life? Do you mean biological human life, or do you mean the sense life in a moral sense? I mean, like we just said, scientifically, we know when life begins, but morally, that's where the debate is when we're lying.
Yeah, so the question, right, is here's one way to think about it. Do all human beings have basic human rights? And I think the best answer I think to give to that question is yes. So one way to think about it is that this is, as the founders of the United States put it, a self-evident truth, right? So in the Declaration of Independence, famously, right, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And when it talks about all men being created equal, somebody would say, oh, well, Jefferson and the founders, they meant all white, rich, land-owning people. That's actually not true. Actually, Jefferson, Adams, and their founders, it's very clear if you look at their other writings, that when they talk about all men, they mean all human beings. They're speaking in an old-fashioned sort of way, but that's what they mean. So it's a little bit like a man eating a lion. What does that mean? That women can go up there and they're not going to be eaten? Well, no, a man eating a lion, the idea is it's eating all human beings. And Jefferson and Adams and the other founders thought of this as a first principle. And not just Jefferson and the founders. If you look at the UN Declaration on Human Rights, again, it says all individuals in the human family have these rights. Yeah, this is the first principle. This is the beginning. So you don't even need a kind of deductive argument to say, oh, well, here's why this is true. This is a foundation for ethical thinking. At least that's one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is to say the reason all human beings have basic human rights is that all human beings are persons. And by persons, I mean individual substances of a rational nature. So all human beings have that in common, whether or not in the moment they're exercising their rational nature. So it'd be similar to say all human beings have a sexual nature. Well, does that mean all human beings are having sex all the time? Well, no, of course not. Babies aren't. But all human beings are the kind of beings, if they're healthy and flourishing, that are capable of reproduction in a sexual way. In other words, human beings, by their nature, don't reproduce by budding, right? We reproduce in a sexual way. So similarly, all human beings have a rational nature. And is it true that there are some human beings, for instance, that are mentally handicapped that don't have the ability to exercise their rational nature? Yeah. But it's precisely because they're human beings and do have a rational nature that we're able to identify them as handicapped, right? That is to say, they have a disability. They have a health problem that prevents their normal human flourishing and development. A third reason to think that all human beings deserve basic rights is one we just talked about, the future like ours argument. Right, so as human beings, we share a characteristic, they're good that we can share in the future, and this is true of another way of supporting the idea that all human beings should be accorded basic rights. And the final reason I think that all human beings should be accorded basic rights has to do with learning from history. If you look in the past, every single time we've divided the human family into two parts, right, those that have basic rights, those that deserve dignity, those that the law protects, and then on the other hand, say to other human beings, well, you don't have rights, you don't have dignity, the law doesn't need to cover you as a person. Whenever we've done this in the past, we've made a terrible, terrible mistake. And I think that people of goodwill can look back and say, yes, when whites did this to blacks, it was a terrible thing. When men did this to women, it was a terrible thing. When Europeans did this to native people, it was a terrible thing. And so I think if we learn from history, we have the strongest reason to think that we should be inclusive, that we should say that all human beings deserve basic human rights.
So just a couple more questions. Real briefly, we have about 10, 15 minutes left to cover the bodily autonomy argument. It's probably probably the most popular pro-choice argument outside the scientific questions. The one put forth by Judith Thompson. And Quentin, I know you and Aaron released a couple episodes on this, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Judith Jarvis Thompson has her famous violinist argument, and just for maybe people who haven't heard of it, the basic idea is that you wake up one morning and you're hooked up to a violinist, and the doctors come in and say, well, You know, I'm sorry to tell you, the violinist has some very serious kidney problems, and so you're going to have to be hooked up to the violinist for the next 9 months. And then, you know, the medicine should, by that time, have healed the violinist, and you can detach from the violinist. And Thompson says, well, it'd be very nice of you. You'd be a good Samaritan if you were to remain hooked up to the violinist indefinitely. But you are a minimally decent Samaritan. You're not a bad person if you detach yourself from the violinist. And so in a similar way, abortion is akin to detaching yourself from the prenatal human being. You're going to cause this person to die, but it is not something that you have to have a duty to sustain the violinist. Now, this scenario has led to countless articles, critiques, saying government's wrong, and then people right, the critique and the critique of the month. So this has been a very generative kind of view. I can't begin to summarize all the different, you know, pro and con. But let me just say a few words about why I think this violinist analogy does not justify abortion. One reason it doesn't is that abortion as actually performed is not at all like a gentle unhooking of the violinist where you just snip the cords that connect you to someone else. Rather, abortion is, as practiced, is a violent impingement on someone else's body. So if you go back to the violinist analogy, you say, well, can you take an axe to the violinist and chop her up into pieces? I mean, think of little, well, no, you can't do that. And that's much more than just gently snipping. Abortion, in other words, is in a case of intentional killing, which, again, is very different than cases of foreseeing that someone's going to die and not preventing it. So if you think about in World War II, you had Adolf Hitler ordering that German troops that retreat be shot and killed. And then you had, so that's the case of intentional killing, right? On the other hand, you had General Eisenhower on D-Day fully foreseeing that on D-Day, many Allied soldiers are going to get killed in invading Normandy, but he didn't intend their deaths at all. This distinction is really important. Think, again, of the difference between a good dentist who may foresee that this dental procedure is going to cause you some pain versus the sadistic dentist, right, who just takes joy and pleasure and is trying to cause pain. But those are very different. A final thing I'll say about the violinist analogy has to do with the difference between what a biological father or biological mother owes to his or her own biological son or daughter, on the one hand, versus what we owe to someone who is not our child, on the other hand. So if a guy gets a woman pregnant, even if he used contraception, even if he didn't want to be a dad, etc., he has a very strong legal and also a very strong moral duty to provide for that child. And in other words, he should, you know, send money. If he's going to be a good dad, he should do a lot more than send money. He should, you know, help with the homework and teach her how to swim and play the piano. I mean, he should be a good dad. There's all those things. And if you were to do all the same things that a good dad does for a total stranger, well, you really would be a good Samaritan. I mean, that's really something if you're just going to, you know, volunteer to teach kids how to swim and volunteer to, you know, pay for their piano practice or lessons and all that. And so biological fathers, just in virtue of being the father of this child, have a very strong obligation. And I say child here on purpose because, remember, Thompson's analogy is supposed to work on the assumption that the human being in utero is a person. So right. given that assumption, it's true that not just the biological father, but also the biological mother has very strenuous duties to aid and help her own biological child. And so, obviously, good parents don't ever intentionally harm their own children. And so this is, again, not being heroic or a good Samaritan, you're so amazing you didn't harm your own child. Well, no, of course I did. This is my own child.
Right.
I have a duty to help this child. So, of course,
right.
I'm not going to harm the child. That's the opposite, obviously, of helping. So anyway, I don't think that the violinist argument works. And, you know, a lot of pro-choice philosophers agree with me. My co-author in the book that comes out next month, Abortion Rights For and Against, she also agrees that, look, Thompson's argument just doesn't work to justify abortion.
Yeah, and I think bringing up the stranger versus parent objection is very important, because Thompson's whole article and argument rests on the assumption that a parent does not have natural obligations to his or her offspring, that your obligations only obtain if you give birth to the child and then you take the child home. And so it's basically chosen, not natural obligations. And I think that that's a pretty absurd way to view the relationship between parent and child. In fact, I think a lot of the, you know, there's been a lot of damage to families because of this lack of idea that there's no natural obligation to a person's offspring. Okay, so we're coming up here to the end of our time together here. So where can people find you online? And are there any other websites or books that you'd like to plug? I know you have a book coming up here. You were talking about Abortion Rights For and Against. Maybe you can talk about that just a little bit to let us know what the purpose of that book is.
Sure. So the book came into being when I was invited by Kate Greasley to Oxford for a seminar. They were having a seminar on abortion and the law. And so I was invited over. They had six speakers, five of whom were defenders of abortion. So I was the one who was pro-life. And anyway, so I gave a presentation, and we, you know, had a very vigorous discussion at the time of the presentation, and then went to dinner afterwards and discussed more. And I'm not sure, actually, if she thought of the idea first or I did, but in any case, we were discussing, and we thought, gosh, well, you know, maybe it would be good to kind of write all this down. I mean, we really disagree, and yet we try to understand each other's point of view and take it seriously and really engage in a civil and rational way. And I thought, you know, maybe there's some value here in, you know, having a written version of this. And again, I don't remember if she thought of this first or I did, but we basically both agreed, yep, that sounds good. So we wrote up a proposal, sent it to Cambridge University Press, and Cambridge said, yep, this looks good. And so the basic way the book works out is she wrote a 30,000-word defense of abortion. I wrote a 30,000-word critique of abortion. And then we exchanged these chapters, and then we each wrote a 10,000-word reply, and then we exchanged those, and then we each wrote a 5,000-word final reply. So basically the book, you know, kind of is divided up in that way. And it was fun to do. You know, I think it's nice in a way to engage with one person. It makes it a little easier in a way than trying to look at the whole field and, you know, it kind of focuses it. And, you know, I'm happy to say that through the whole process, you know, even though, again, we don't agree on this topic, you know, it was a kind of cordial process. I mean, we didn't, I don't know, getting into fights with each other, and I just kind of cooperated. And anyway, so the book is scheduled to come out November 27th or something or other.
Just in time for Christmas.
Just in time for Christmas, exactly. Right. You know, under the tree, no, what's better than abortion rights for and against? This is
right, exactly.
And look for it in airports. I expect it'll be in airports across the country. And no, I don't
right.
think so, but.
Yeah, and so who is your co-author for this book?
Kate Greasley. She's a philosopher, does philosophy of law. She's written a book with Oxford University Press on abortion. It came out 1 or 2 years ago. So she's the co-author.
Okay, and so where can people find you online?
Well, if you Google my name, you'll see I have a website at LMU, and they can check me out there. And I also have a Facebook account, Christopher Kaiser, so people can connect with me there if they like.
Okay.
But yeah, that's where I am.
Okay, so I'd like to thank everyone for listening in. And Chris, I'd like to thank you again for joining us and allowing us to interview you.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great having a chance to talk about this very important issue with you both. Thanks very much.
And you're going to be giving a talk here tonight in San Diego, and I really wish I could attend that, but unfortunately my situation just didn't allow me to break away from Fresno here.
I understand. If I could bilocate, I would be doing a lot more things than I am doing. But anyway, yeah, sorry I won't be
right.
there, but hopefully you'll get a chance to, if it's reported, to see what happens.
Yeah, I'd love to. And Nathan, thanks again for joining us and setting up the interview. Yeah. So if you appreciate the content that's been disseminated here in this podcast. We just ask that you share this around wherever you happen to be located on social media, rate and review us on our Facebook page, and also on iTunes. And now this is a weekly podcast, and it takes a lot of work to put together a podcast each week on top of all the other work that I do in the pro-life movement. As Greg Cunningham of Center for Bioethical Reform says, there are more people working full-time to kill unborn babies than there are people working full-time to save them. I subsist off of donations from financial supporters. People like you keep me being able to do the work that I do. If you like what we're doing with this podcast and would like to support my work as a full-time pro-life advocate, you can go to www.prolifetraining.com, which is the Life Training Institute website, and click on donate in the menu on the top. You can give a one-time gift or you can give a monthly gift. Just be sure to put my name in the notes section so that Life Training Institute knows to put your donation into my account. And if you'd like to donate to this podcast specifically, make sure to put that in the notes section also. And donations are also tax deductible. Now, unfortunately, because life has just been real hectic for the past several weeks, I've gotten a little bit behind on our weekly schedule for releasing podcasts. And I hope to get the last two episodes that we've recorded out soon, hopefully, if not this week, then by next week. But we did record a new episode this week, which we'll get out just as soon as possible. And the topic of this one was actually the burning IVF facility thought experiment, since it entered the public consciousness with Patrick S. Tomlinson's recent tweets. And so look for that real soon. I hope to get that out this week, if not this week, then by next week. So be looking for that soon. So once again, on behalf of Nathan and all of us here at Pro-Life Thinking, I'd like to thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.